Yes, sir, we promised you a great
gorgeous
main
event. Gorgeous George, here
we go. Blassie, the maker of champions.
Andre, the giant.
WrestleMania!
Do I have everybody's attention now?
The Right Hook is a Pantsless Digression production.
Do you like parties?
Yeah.
We can invite all our friends and have soda and pie.
Yeah!
I hope no bad people show up.
Disregard that, Frank. It's a bunch of liberal bullshit.
Been alive and keep talk for the box still. From the streets to Shanghai back to Knoxville. Getting high on the mountain top. Holy shop, spreading the good news. Been a lot of false prophets and quick hits. And a lot of un-American bullshit. But the time has come to settle and the devil's gonna make me choose. And just like a cold wind blowing, can you feel me coming to you? Just like a freight train rolling back tight full of rhythm to blues.
We've got School Choice Week next week. We wanted to focus on education reform. The Wolf, it's a big political issue, or at least it should be. Unfortunately, candidates aren't really talking about it. But I know last year the Wall Street Journal had called school choice and education reform the issue for 2011. 2011 was supposed to be the year for education reform, so we'll be talking about that. We'll be talking to Anthony Scuderi, who is a gentleman here on Long Island who is working to save one of the recent Catholic schools that were shut down. And it's not really a charter, but it's more like an academy where they want to lease for the school. And we're going to be talking to him about that and how that's going. I hope and I think we have Bob Bowden from the Cartel and from Choice Media TV. I say I hope because I may have dropped the ball with confirming the interview. So hopefully we have him on, and if not, I do have a contingency plan. But coming up next, or first, she's the education policy analysis for the Heritage Foundation, making her debut on The Right Hook. Lindsay Burke, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
To start off, why don't you give your audience a little of your background in why you decided to focus on education reform as an issue?
Sure. Well, I am with the Heritage Foundation, and education is one of our key initiatives that we focus on, and we focus very closely on restoring federalism in education, so restoring state and local control over education where it rightly belongs, and school choice as well, and really putting control of education into the hands of parents. So those are our two main focuses, and it's been a lot of work, but I think we're making a lot of progress.
And I know I saw one of the reports that you did near the end of last year focuses on education savings account as an effective tool to reform education. I know we hear a lot of health savings accounts thrown around as a way to reform health care. What exactly education savings account, and how exactly would those work and help?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. You mentioned that the Wall Street Journal deemed 2011 the year of school choice, and that was such an exciting milestone. But what's so innovative right now are some of the approaches some states are taking. So Arizona has just created education savings accounts, and these ESAs, you mentioned health savings accounts, it's similar. So a parent who decides to take their child out of the public school system, and this is only for special needs students right now, but if they feel that the public system is not meeting their needs, they can remove their child from the school, and then they get deposited into their education savings account whatever the school would have spent on their child. And then they can use that money to pay for private school tuition, to pay for online learning, to pay for special education services. So they can pay for a wide array of educational services. And then if they have money left over, they can roll it over year to year. They can even save it and roll it into a 529 college savings account. So it's a very innovative way to think about school choice.
Mm-hmm. Now, it sounds almost a little like a 401k where you can invest and you have certain options, but in some cases those options are limited. would the options be limited to what parents can choose from, or it's just it's their money, whatever they want to spend it on, just so long as it goes to, towards the education of their child?
Yeah, so it's exactly that. The options are limitless, really, and that's what's so interesting, and that's what's unique about Ed Savings Accounts. You know, a voucher is fantastic, but a voucher is a voucher, and you take it to a private school. An Ed Savings Account, you can break that money up, and you can write a check out of your ESA account for various types of educational services. So it really maximizes the amount of flexibility you have to tailor and really customize your child's educational experience.
You had mentioned how one of the goals for the Heritage Foundation is to restore federalism. I mean, in all sorts of issues, but we're talking specifically about education reform. It's being brought up on – you have been brought up with the presidential debates a little bit of No Child Left Behind. Specifically, I believe Rick Santorum was a supporter of it. I'm not entirely positive about that. But even though it was a Republican-led initiative, doesn't seem to be all that popular amongst conservatives. Where exactly does No Child Left Behind get it wrong?
You know, and I think that there is disdain for the law on both sides of the political spectrum. So we really see some bipartisan distaste for the law. But what is different and what's interesting about the debate is that, you know, while both sides agree that No Child Left Behind is broken, the Obama administration and the left do not believe that the federal role in education is fundamentally flawed. And so that's where we really see some division in what to do moving forward. So everyone agrees that it's bad policy and it's not working well for children or for schools, but what do we do going forward? And so conservatives say, you know what, let's just get rid of it. Let's allow states to completely opt out of No Child Left Behind and allow them to direct how they're going to use education dollars. But unfortunately, we see the administration trying to tweak No Child Left Behind around the edges. And in fact, and of even greater concern, the Obama administration has started handing out waivers for No Child Left Behind, which at first blush seems like, oh, it's not a bad idea. You know, we want to give states relief, but it's not genuine relief because the administration, not surprisingly, has decided to attach strings to these waivers. So if a state wants a waiver, wants relief from No Child Left Behind, they have to agree to the administration's preferred policies. And so you effectively have the administration rewriting No Child Left Behind from the White House through executive fiat.
Mm-hmm. Like we had mentioned before, the Wall Street Journal called 2011 like the year for education reform. And I know a lot of state houses and a lot of governors trying different things that to try and help give more power into the hands of the parents and actually, you know, educate the kids and get them out of school. What do you think have been some of the laws or some of the advancements in education reform that took place in 2001 that you find particularly interesting?
Well, I mentioned Arizona. The Ed Savings Account piece is just so incredibly innovative. And I think as we see the educational landscape change dramatically, and we are seeing a seismic shift toward more online learning, moves like providing education savings accounts are really going to facilitate that growth. So that's very exciting. But you also have places like Indiana under the leadership of Governor Daniels. Indiana created a voucher program last year that will, over the course of the next 3 years, provide 600,000 children with access to private schools. So that is just so incredible. Of course, we kicked off the year last year with the reauthorization of the D.C. Opportunity Scholarship Program, which is the voucher program in the nation's capital, and was really a point of contention. We saw 2 years ago the Obama administration really standing by as Congress worked to phase out the voucher program in D.C., which has been highly successful by every objective measure, by the Department of Education's own evaluations. It has worked to increase academic achievement, to increase graduation rates, and yet pressure from special interest groups, the teachers' union, basically led the Obama administration to stand by as it was phased out. But 2011 kicked off with Speaker Boehner really pushing to get that program reauthorized, and now thousands of kids in D.C. once again have access to vouchers. So that was a good move. So we're seeing all types of school choice programs, whether it's tuition tax credit programs like Florida has, or voucher programs, Ed Savings Accounts, expansions in online learning and charter schools. And that's really what we want to see. We want to see parents have access to a wide range of educational options. Really, it's almost like a menu approach to education where you can pick and choose and customize an education that's best for your child.
You had mentioned teacher unions before, and I know a lot of times we get so when we're arguing like left versus right in politics, we get so caught up in who we're used to blaming things on. And when it comes to education reform, in a lot of cases, the target is usually it's the teachers' unions getting in the way of any changes, any reforms you want to make to help the students. How much is it really all them? And when you consider that you've got people like Al Sharpton and Bill Maher who are the polar opposite generally of what we think, even saying, you know, the unions go so far, how do they still have all this power?
You know, it's unfortunate, but I think the teachers' unions really do deserve a lot of the blame for the failure in our education system. They have really pushed back against any threat to the status quo. They push back against reforms that are in the best interest of students, reforms like alternative teacher certification so we can get mid-career professionals into the classroom more easily. They push against things like merit pay so we can reward them once we're there. And, of course, they fight vehemently against providing school choice options because they know that once parents have a choice, they might not choose the government school system. And so they are pushing back against reforms that we know work, that objectively we have a robust and growing body of empirical evidence to support. And so they really have been one of the biggest obstacles. And if you need any help getting Bob Bowden to talk about this, let me know, because he really has done great work on exposing a lot of the problems with the education union. So. But it is. It's a big problem, and I think they do deserve, unfortunately, much of the blame for blocking reform all these years.
Well, when you look at them fighting against reform as hard as they do, case in point would be Wisconsin. There was Wisconsin battles last year with Governor Walker, where everything you're saying to me and probably most of our audience is preaching to the choir. But when it comes to the unions battling Scott Walker or any other Republican conservative governor, it's always, well, you hate the students, you hate the kids. Usually they find a way to call them racist. People are greedy. And more often than not, the people who don't pay that close attention seem to empathize with the argument from the unions more. Messaging-wise, what are some things we could do to combat that to actually point out, well, look, it's not that we hate anyone, but we're trying to help the children learn and, you know, be able to better themselves.
You know, I think first and foremost, it is an issue of putting the needs of children ahead of the needs of the adults in the system. And this has been a system for decade after decade that has been serving the needs of the adults. And we need to start really thinking in terms of what's best for children. And if we stand back and think about that clear-headed and objectively, it's pretty clear that the education unions have not always been serving the needs of the children. And the second thing I think we need to remember is that there's a big difference between private and public sector unions. And when you have teachers unions, you have public sector unions that basically make the government a special interest group in and of itself. And that's a big problem. And so we need to start thinking about differences between public and private sector unions. And I think, finally, we need to think about what Governor Walker did in Wisconsin and what other governors across the country are doing that want to limit the power of these public sector unions as providing choices for teachers, not only for children, but for teachers. Before Governor Walker put these reforms into place, if you wanted to teach or be employed by the education system at all in Wisconsin, you had to join a union or fork over union dues. Now if you want to teach, you have a choice. And that's so important to remember because these unions, you take the National Education Association, for instance, and they have a war chest of $355 million. They spend that money on all types of organizations, candidates, causes, spending money on ACORN, for instance. You name it, the money goes to some places that you, as a teacher, might not want to support. And when you consider the fact that 95% of the NEA's contributions go to Democrats and left-leaning causes, and then you contrast that with the fact that about half of teachers consider themselves more conservative than liberal and yet are forced to join a union, you know that many teachers are being forced to contribute to organizations that they do not support. So I think there are a lot of reasons why we need to think about limiting the power of these public sector unions.
Hopefully it's not looking that way in a lot of the primary debates we've had so far, but hopefully once we get in the presidential race, we're actually going to see a serious debate on education reform. I know the president's, one of the president's big things were the race to the top. And personally, I don't think our candidates are have been talking about education reform enough, if at all. Out of the people who are currently running to be the Republican nominee, are you seeing anyone with any interesting plans that you find particularly useful, particularly interesting, or are they just not talking about education reform enough?
Well, you know, I'll preface this by saying that we're a 501c3. We're not a political organization. We're a policy organization. Mm-hmm. But it would be nice to see more people talk about education as a big issue. And I think we will see that over the next year because it truly is an issue. Many people have called this a civil rights issue of our time. So I think it's something that will come to the fore as we move forward. But I think you mentioned race to the top. It's important to remember race to the top was a pretty significant chunk of money. It was $4.35 billion. It was the Obama administration really leveraging money from the stimulus to push their kind of brand of education reform. So you've got race to the top, $4 billion. You had $100 billion, a one-time bonus, if you will, carved out of the stimulus and gifted to the Department of Education on top of their annual $50 billion discretionary budget. So we're seeing this administration spend money on education like no administration before them. And so I think this idea that we need to continue to spend more and more money on public education, I think we need to take a step back and look at the significant increases we've seen over the past few years, particularly under this administration.
Okay. Well, Lindsay Burke from Heritage Foundation, thank you for joining us. And we'll talk to you about education reform in the future soon.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay. That was Lindsay Burke, the education policy analyst for the Heritage Foundation. And we'll be right back.
This is Andrew Breitbart, and you're listening to FPR Radio.
Tired of having feelings? Get rid of those counterproductive emotions of depression, anger, and anxiety. BLI brand medication makes life better. Talk to your doctor today and eliminate all of your problems. BLI brand medication for a better tomorrow.
Keeping it tuned to the right hook. Of course, you could follow us on the internet at twitter.com/righthookny, facebook.com/therighthook, and at our newly launched www.righthookny.com blog. I'm focusing more on that than the old johnbrodigan.com blog, but you can still follow me on twitter.com/brodigan, and that pretty much sums up our social media presence. Before we move forward, you may have noticed I've been playing more than a little bit of old school Van Halen in the bumper music and the entrance music as people come onto the show. I figured I'd make Van Halen the featured artist this week because if you're like me and you saw the video for Tattoo, you sat there in shock and are wondering how exactly they were able to produce such a piece of crap. I mean, it's a song about tattoos and you see them playing a show to an empty studio in black and white, looking old, and someone thought that was a good idea. So that disappointed me. I wanted to remember the Van Halen of my youth. So we'll be doing that this week on the show. Okay, our next guest got heavily involved with the school choice movement with his documentary, The Cartel, and also later just recently launched the ChoiceMediaTV.com, which is basically, do you want stop internet hub for all things education reform? We're proud to have him on the show. And of course, I hit the wrong button. One second. Bob Bowden, welcome to The Right Hook.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it. That music, I feel empowered and emboldened. It's like an adrenaline boost has surged into my bloodstream.
I needed to do anything to wash away the stink of that last video they posted last week, so I'm going old school for the music this week.
Okay. What video? To what video do you refer?
Their new song, Tattoo. And if you haven't heard of it, you're better off. Just forget this conversation
ever
happened.
I heard about this. I have not heard the song, but I suspect it doesn't harken back to the glory days based on your appraisal.
It doesn't harken back to the glory days of the Gary Sharon era.
Okay. So noted.
Well, like I mentioned in the introduction, you had actually, I guess, first burst onto the education reform scene with the documentary The Cartel. Why don't you just give us a little bit of your background prior to that movie and why you decided to make it in the first place?
I had been a TV reporter most of my career, covering stock market news, and a technology reporter also, doing web coverage of internet companies for Bloomberg Television and for syndicated shows and media outlets. But I had done a few education stories along the way, and occasionally had been dumbfounded or sometimes even infuriated with what I found. Wonderful trial programs, pilot programs that the kids liked and the teachers liked, and they were just killed by the teachers' unions if these kinds of things, you know, might involve an economy of scale that the union couldn't control, and things like this. But then the real catalyst was a close friend of mine got a job as an inner-city high school English teacher, and I started hearing her stories on a daily basis of what it was like. And it struck me that I thought to myself, I don't think a lot of people know what's going on these days in urban high schools, and I want to start doing some interviews about this. And then the next thing you know, I had a feature-length film, which went on to win 12 film festival awards, distribution from Warner Brothers, really exploded.
Mm-hmm. And your movie actually came out before Waiting for Superman, which a lot of people are looking to as, like, you know, the big movie. Did you notice a lot of added attention to your film after that came out?
It was an interesting situation because Superman started as a studio film, unlike mine, which started as an independent film and then got distribution later. But Waiting for Superman was a Paramount film from the beginning, and the director, as you probably know, Davis Guggenheim, had an Oscar already from An Inconvenient Truth, the climate change film he did with Al Gore. And so he started with money and reputation, and they had a multi-million-dollar advertising budget, you know. So after my film had come out, when Superman came out the festival premieres differed it was somewhat different than the theatrical release premieres. But by theatrical release, it was probably 6 to 8 months difference between the films in theatrical release. So 6 or 8 months later, when Waiting for Superman came out, you know, people were asking me, like, if I was going to be, you know, offended by the fact they had more advertising money and they were going to be able to launch in so many more theaters and all this stuff. And in fact, I felt the opposite. It really gave an enormous boost to the Cartel movie because there were all kinds of newspaper stories, coverage, press accounts that mentioned the two films in the same story, in USA Today, I can't even list them, a whole variety of major wire stories and newspaper stories, you know, referred to all of them, all these movies together, and in particular The Cartel and Waiting for Superman. So it was really good for my film, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And The Cartel took place where you're from, New Jersey, and one of the I say forefather only because a lot of the attention to education reform has really been for the past couple of years. But one of the forefathers for the movement and a lightning rod for anything that goes to challenging the unions is Chris Christie, governor of New Jersey. What's been your opinion of him as far as an education reformer goes? And I also believe, I think I just saw something, he launched a new initiative in his State of the State address, if you know anything about that.
Well, yes. In fact, it's the lead story on choicemedia.tv right now, if people are listening live.
That's where I read it from.
Uh-huh, sure. So it was delivered this afternoon, and he mentioned in a six-point plan for education reform, including getting rid of LIFO. That's short for last in, first out, which means when spending reductions do happen or budget cuts happen or enrollment drops, that instead of the weakest teachers being let go, they just by law let go only the newest teachers. So if there's a fantastic, motivated, energetic, smart, great young new teacher, they will get the axe when perhaps some other teacher who's maybe had a few years on the job will get to keep their job. And no one would run a business this way. I mean, you would not let your better employee go, particularly if it's a demonstrably better employee, while you keep your weaker employee. But that happens all the time. And there are a lot of great older teachers and more experienced teachers too. But I'm just saying that they're quality doesn't exactly line up with seniority, and by law in New Jersey and so many states around the country, almost every state around the country, that's precisely how teachers are laid off whenever cutbacks do happen. That was just one of the reforms. He was also proposing changing tenure, where teachers who receive low evaluations essentially lose their guaranteed job for life. And it's all outlined on the story right now at choicemedia.tv. Yeah, in full disclosure, the governor, Governor Christie, has been really good to me and the Cartel movie. He endorsed the film very early on. Before I'd even met him, he was talking about it on the radio, on radio interviews, at press conferences, and then later sat down with me for a feature-length education reform policy interview that's DVD or Blu-ray extra if people buy the movie through the website and get the DVD or the Blu-ray, they get a full-length interview with me and Governor Christie. So I always like to include that disclaimer.
And you'd also mentioned Choice Media, which, unlike what I said before, choicemediatv.com, it's actually choicemedia.tv. You launched it this year. It's kind of like, for the most part, it's like your one-stop shop for all things education reform. People want to go for resources. People want to upload their own stories. What made you decide to launch it, and what are you hoping to do with it?
Well, this was missing in the education reform movement. Basically, a place to go that is we also produce original video documentary content from all around the country, chronicling everything from the waste, fraud, corruption, abuse kinds of stories, as well as legislative updates and all kinds of guest videos people can upload, particular stories about things happening in their town or their city, as well as links to pretty much every major education reform story that's happening in the country. There's an interactive map. People can click on their states and get news pertaining to just their state. This really just didn't exist anywhere else. We have a store. People can buy books and movies, including The Cartel and other education reform related films, through choicemedia.tv, and as well as a calendar of events, upcoming conferences and whatnot. So yeah, we really did want to, we thought there'd just be a value as this issue is getting bigger and bigger. It's not going away. Charter schools are growing at a tremendous rate all around the country. Other movements like homeschooling is growing as well. You have voucher initiatives in places like Indiana that just passed a statewide voucher bill. Other places that have special needs vouchers like Oklahoma and Georgia and Florida. You have the Wisconsin reforms, for which there was news coverage last March with Governor Walker in Wisconsin. But many of these reforms are really groundbreaking and could not have even been conceived even just 2 years ago. So we thought there should be a place that covers these developments, and choicemedia.tv aims to be it.
We had, before you came on, we had Lindsay Burke from the Heritage Foundation on, and we were talking about the teachers' unions. And I'd said before, in a lot of cases, particularly when it comes to arguing politics, where you've got left versus right, conservative versus liberal, you know, we have our set scapegoats that we keep in mind for the reason why people aren't doing things our way. And the teachers union is a popular one for when it comes to education reform. Is it really just the unions standing in the way of education reform, or am I missing something? Because it seems like no matter when you have people like Al Sharpton and Bill Maher who are even like sour on the teachers unions, they've got to be doing something wrong, yet still hold way too much power.
Well, I do think there has been a sea change even in just the last 2 years, really. The movies we talked about helped do that. The Education Nation series on NBC helped do that. That's their one week every year focus on the issue. There's just the populist messaging. You know, Chris Christie's done a lot for that. Scott Walker's done a lot for that. Jeb Bush has done a lot. So there have been a lot of leaders, but also not all Republicans either. There's been... Cory Booker, of course, the mayor of Newark, has been a leader on this, as well as the Obama administration with the Race to the Top initiative that was really good for the promotion of charter schools all around the country, and also beyond that, changing a lot of the rules that were Byzantine and very many ways made the unions behave like a 19th century industrialized union model. Yes, so much really has changed in just a short amount of time. You can't say it's just the unions, getting back to your question, because there are places where some states, by the way, where there technically aren't unions in the sense of collective bargaining, there are still teachers associations or administrator associations that also do things like, you know, keep the bureaucracy in place, so they still make it really hard to fire a teacher, even if they're not doing collective bargaining on salaries or on benefits. They still work the system to make things like assigning teachers a very cumbersome process and bureaucratic process. And you know, as I like to say in the film The Cartel, we showed we showed janitors in public schools that, including overtime, made six figures, made over $100,000 in a single year. Janitors we're talking about. I mean, that's not the teachers union that did that. And we found examples of superintendents with severances of $1 million or more. Even just recently in Philadelphia, Arlene Ackerman got a $1.3 million severance if you add together her private and public money. That's not the teachers union that gave the superintendents those huge severances. Or a school building in Los Angeles that in one school building, it cost $500 million to build one high school at the location of the old Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. I mean, that wasn't a teachers union that drove up those prices. What it is in general, and that's why we use the term the cartel, it's a collection of entities that are invested in stifling reform, keeping the money flowing, paying everyone off. It's a collection of groups that become invested essentially in this idea that we need to keep doing it the old way, except throw more money at the problem, and that's who's reigned powerful and supreme in this industry.
Yeah. Wall Street Journal called 2011 the year of education reform, and 2012 we got the big presidential race where. I personally don't hear our candidates or the Republican candidates talking about education reform that much or at all. Going into 2001, where it's considered the year of education reform, where do we where do you think the movement's going to go in 2012? And do you hear anyone talking about anything interesting like this year, or are you looking to hear more specific education plans?
Well, sure. I mean, Governor Corbett of Pennsylvania has said that vouchers would be a priority in his state. We just talked about the New Jersey plans laid out by Governor Christie. We have other initiatives. Governor Deal in Georgia is basically creating a new charter model because the Supreme Court of the state of Georgia essentially struck down the existence of state chartered schools. And so they're going to fight back and have vowed to put charters on a better footing in Georgia. There's also proposals known as the the parent trigger laws, which were passed in California, and originally they have not been used nearly as much as a lot of ed reformers would hope. But in fact, there's a belief that they'll catch on and actually be have some new momentum in 2012. I think there's a lot to be sanguine about, actually, this year. As we go forward, and, you know, of course, you never know. The presidential campaigns, you know, usually there's not a lot of education talk when it comes to presidential campaigns. We'll see. So far, the Republican debates have had almost zero spoken about education. And it, in fairness, it is mostly a local and state issue still. But we'll see as we move forward if the No Child Left Behind reauthorization becomes a larger issue in the general election. It might be.
Okay. Well, Bob Bowden from thecartelmovie.com and choicemedia.tv. Do you have anything special planned for School Choice Week next week?
Sure. I'm going to be speaking in Louisville, Kentucky, also Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and Jersey City, New Jersey, and a couple other dates potential that are not quite confirmed yet. But, yeah, everybody listening to this right now should be checking out and getting involved in not just the education reform movement in general, but School Choice Week in particular. It's January 22nd to 28th. You can find out all you want at schoolchoiceweek.com. There are over 200 events happening all around the country. This is just the second year that this event has happened. And there's a huge kickoff coming this Saturday, January 21st, in New Orleans, which I'll be flying down to for that. And so it's really great. I mean, it's everything from panel discussions and speeches and screenings of new films. And so it's pretty exciting stuff.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining us tonight. We'll talk to you soon, and keep on fighting the good fight.
Anytime. I appreciate it. Thank you.
That was Bob Bowden, and we will be right back. You're listening to The Right Hook.
At night I watch it, singing street lamps, the crazy sound my block, and I see the same old faces, and I hear that same old talk, and I'm searching for the latest thing, I break in this routine, I'm talking some new
Hi, this is Dana Farino, and you're listening to FTR Radio.
Please stare into the center of the moving shade. I'm so happy to be alive. Everything is going to be fine. Did I take my medication today? Keep working hard and stay alive. Goodbye.
To The Right Hook. I, of course, am Brodigan, your host. Thanks for joining us. For our third and final guest, we're moving things a little local. This gentleman's name is Anthony Scuderi. He's in charge of SaveLaSalleRegional.org. It's here on Long Island, the diocese shut down a couple of Catholic schools, and we're looking to keep one of them open for and has the community involved. But since he can explain it more than I can, ladies and gentlemen.
Anthony Scuderi, welcome to The Right Hook.
Oh, excuse me, I'm sorry. Good evening. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. We've been talking about School Choice Week next week, we've been talking a lot about the concepts behind how maybe allowing more charter schools and different ways to reform an education system.
I know that you are actually actively trying to convert a school to a charter school, which I want to get to in a minute, but before we do, let's backtrack a little bit to get some of the history behind it. What happened to a lot of the schools, the Catholic schools on Long Island, specifically, I believe it's LaSalle, which is the one that you're looking to convert?
What's been going on is that to give you my background, I've been a parent at the school, the LaSalle School, the St. John the Baptist Day LaSalle School in Farmingdale for the past 20 years, because I have children in a wide spread of years, so I've been involved in that long, and in that time I can tell you that I have not seen enough investment from the diocese in promoting these schools, in marketing these schools, in presenting them for what they are, which is wonderful clusters of Christianity and Christian community and fellowship. One of the things I think that the diocese overlooks in not supporting these schools is that they represent the best avenue that they have for bringing young families back to church. My wife will tell you countless stories of young moms who only intended on using our pre-K programs and wound up, them and their children ended up falling in love with the school and going all through the eighth grade and graduating. The schools are currently, our school and I think several of the others are currently operating in the black, so this doesn't make sense to us that they would be shutting down our school. But in watching the gradual decline in these schools and the diocese not really investing and promoting the schools, there are examples out there of where we can find a better solution. And in the better solution, what I mean is the Diocese of Brooklyn is dealing with a similar issue. But if you go on their website, their strategy is to build Catholic academies, which are independently run. We're doing research. My research committee is doing research to find out where they get their funding. Some of them are getting some kind of funding from the Brooklyn Diocese, I'm not sure. But the approach is really what we're looking at, that it's a much better way of handling the situation than to continually closing schools. So we would like the opportunity for the Diocese of Rockville Center to accept our proposal to build a Catholic academy, a privately run corporation to provide Catholic elementary school to the community of Farmingdale and the surrounding towns. The diocese states that they have a strategy, and that strategy, from what we have seen, has only been to close schools. If they had a real strategy, then they would keep our school open because we are centrally located. In fact, we're surrounded by 9 parishes, all of which do not have schools. So to close us is to disenfranchise a huge block of the middle class right in the middle of Long Island. The interesting thing, too, is that each parish is still required to contribute toward Catholic elementary school education. And so the question is, if each one is still required to contribute, and yet our school is being closed, it seems to be a redistribution of wealth away from our area to some of these other parishes, many of which are more affluent than in Farmingdale.
I got to backtrack one second because you would I think a lot of people, when they read about the Catholic school closings, without reading too much into the numbers, you figure between you're always reading about declining roles at the church in general, but also with the economy, you can understand people deciding to, instead of sending their kids to a private school, going to a free public school. So you would assume the schools are not making money; they can't afford to keep them open. If the schools are operating in the black, which means, I don't want to say spurning a profit because it's a school, but if they can afford to stay open, why are we closing 7 of them and leaving pretty much leaving the buildings vacant?
Yeah, the number right now is actually 6. They closed one last year. So it's been a continual, in my 20 years involved in this, it's been a continual downward spiral. But they're currently closing 6, and I know at least one other one which is also operating in the black, which, yeah, it seems to us that the strategic plan was really to go out there and try to cut their labor costs and close six schools and not promote Catholic elementary school education. But in our research, we have a research committee. We came up with a 2005 document that was put out by the United States Conference of Bishops. And in that document, they renew their commitment to provide Catholic elementary school education to all income levels, and that it should be that it should be affordable, available, and accessible. But as many of our parents are seeing, it's not accessible if you have to put seven-year-olds and six-year-olds on a school bus and send them on 135 Secret Oyster Express, with two towns away, in order for them to get a Catholic elementary school education. So we don't really believe that the bishop is living up to that commitment that the United States Conference on Bishops put forth to renew their commitment to and state clearly that there is a responsibility upon everyone involved in the church, from the bishops to the priests to the lay people, to provide Catholic elementary school education to the community. And we want to help them live up to that commitment. If their resources are getting too scarce, then the way to go would be the model that Brooklyn is using, is form privately run academies, and let's see how they operate.
Has there been any feedback from the diocese yet about what you're planning on doing? Has anyone actually heard, you know, gotten an explanation out of the bishop, or is everyone pretty much operating in the blind right now?
We're pretty much operating in the blind. After every rally, the news organizations will ask the diocesan office whether their position is the same, and they keep coming back and saying that it's the same. So we're not getting any satisfaction, and that's one of the things that's very frustrating, is we're not some fringe group. We represent the faithful. We represent people who support our parish and support our church. And for them to just dismiss any idea that we would have does not show us as their community the amount of respect that we want to help, and we recognize and want to embrace our responsibility to provide Catholic elementary school education to the community. So we just don't understand it, but I've got a committed group of young parents, and they're amazing me with their hard work. It's become a second job for about 15 people in the school community. The rest of the LaSalle family, we call it, has also been incredibly supportive. We've had a huge rally in Farmingdale. We have another rally coming up in Rockville Center, where we are actually combining forces with the other five schools which are closing. And this is a rally in support of Catholic school education.
And I know the decision to incorporate and to try and convert to a charter school, at least that I first heard about, was at the rally in Farmingdale last Saturday. Is there a time frame? Obviously, you want to have it done by June before the school closed, but is there a time frame when you're planning on having certain things done? Or what are some of the things that go into actually converting the school to a charter organization?
Well, yeah, that's a good question, and I've got people on our research committee who are investigating that. We're visiting other schools. We're trying to set up meetings with some of these academies to see what their process was for becoming an academy. We wouldn't be really a charter school in the sense of the New York City charter schools, because since we are a religious organization, we wouldn't be entitled to state funding that they would be getting. But we would operate sort of in the same way, and I think that's where people are going. Even though there is demographics are showing that there is declining populations, I think people more and more are looking toward a smaller environment rather than the large institutional type of learning environments that some of the public schools can be. And I'm not knocking the public school system. I think they do a great job. I just think that the smaller community type model is a terrific way to educate your children.
Okay. And if people want to find more information about what you guys are trying to do...
Right, they can go to our website. If they can contribute, that would be great. You know, we're getting we're reaching out to everybody in our community. We're coming up. We're using the talents of our community. So we're reaching out to the attorneys in our community and the accountants in our community. But we're trying to advertise. So all of this costs money. So if anybody wants to contribute to our cause, we certainly appreciate it. And the website is SaveLaSalle.org.
Okay, Anthony Scuderi from SaveLaSalle.org. Good luck with what you're trying to do, and we'll keep in touch and talk to you soon.
Okay, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
And that's our show, our very special education reform show to kick off School Choice Week. We will see you next week, where still working out the guests, but it's going to have more of a mixed martial arts flair, just because that's how we do. But anyway, in closing, since this is education reform / school choice week and an education reform / school choice show, the greatest education reform themed song in the history of modern music. Thank you for watching The Right Hook. Listen to The Right Hook.
I don't feel dirty.